So why does God permit suffering? This, I don't think, actually is the main theme of Job. But it clearly is an important one. It clearly is a fundamental issue that is being addressed here. And moreover, the question that's being addressed here is, why does somebody like Job suffer? Look at, say, chapter 1. We just get a sense of who Job was. When the period of feasting of his sons had run its course, Job would send and have them purified. Early in the morning he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular custom. These feasts that they had, there's lots of different suggestions about it. Some people say that it was on their birthdays that they went to the various feasts. I don't think that's true at all. It seems to me that what you had is these seven sons living in near proximity with one another, and on a particular point in the year, they had a feast that lasted 7 days. And it started in the first son's house, and then in the next son's house, and then in the next son's house, and it finished with this purification sacrifice. And I wonder whether it's almost a prototypical Feast of Unleavened Bread, that you've got these 7 days of feasting leading up to the final sacrifice. Whether that's the case or not, I'm not sure. The point is, however, that Job is in some sense participating in this, and what's more, he's making sure. I don't think Job is saying, well, my children might have sinned, so let me on the side slip God a $10 bill and hope everything will be okay. That's not what Job is all about here. He's about bringing his children and saying, let us together have a sacrifice, in case any of us have sinned. And so he's very concerned about the notion of sin, very concerned that his children should be aware of it, I think, and overcome sin. Look how the Lord views Job in verse 8. Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. Look, throughout the world, he is the best man alive. There's no one on earth like him. He's blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Just every aspect of Job's life was focused purely on the service of God. He was approved by God. And when Job himself is describing how he felt in his relationship with God, look at chapter 29 and verse 4. There's some remarkable speeches, 29, 30 and 31, that we'll consider in some detail in the exhortation on Sunday. But chapter 29 and verse 4, he says, oh, for the days when I was in my prime, when God's intimate friendship blessed my house. It would be great to say that about our houses, wouldn't it? When God's intimate friendship blessed my house. And I've heard some people say, well, Job, the main problem with Job was that he had this rather legalistic approach to righteousness, that he knew that these were the things that he had to do, and so he made sure that he did them. Chapter 31, verse 1. I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. What law was he breaking to look lustfully at a girl? There was no law about that. And yet what we're seeing here is a man who understands Matthew 5 and 6 so many years before they're written. When Jesus says, look, don't you appreciate that this is what righteousness is about? Go beyond what's written. Make sure that you're pure internally, not just in the way that you behave. Job understands this. I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl, he says. He knows that righteousness is internal. And so we have this situation of somebody who is very good. He is put forward here, at least as far as the record is concerned, and as far as God's assessment of him is concerned, as somebody who is essentially faultless. And I don't want to stretch that too far, but I think that that's the picture that we're being given. A little bit like Joseph. We're presented Joseph as somebody who is essentially faultless. And in the same way, so we are with Job. And so the question is, why does somebody like Job suffer? And obviously the simple punishment and reward beliefs of the friends are completely objectionable to Job. The fact that they're saying, look, Job, you must actually be sinful. We know what you used to be like. You used to be good, but now that this has happened to you, it must be because you've been doing something sinful. Job objects to this 100%. Chapter 6 and verse 28. This is his first speech. His second speech. His first speech in response to Eliphaz. And so his immediate response to Eliphaz, saying, look, maybe you've done something wrong, or actually he says it a little stronger, you have done something wrong, you better repent. Verse 28 of chapter 6, but now be so kind as to look at me. Would I lie to your face? Relent, do not be unjust. Reconsider, for my integrity is at stake. Is there any wickedness on my lips? Can my mouth not discern malice? And so Job recognizes that the accusations of the friends are actually making his situation worse. If they'd come to him and they'd said, we appreciate what effort you put into pleasing God, and we acknowledge that what has come upon you has come for a reason that we don't understand, perhaps they'd just said something that simple, then Job would have felt supported. But instead, they look at the situation and they speak from their fear and they say, you must be a sinner, Job. And now they heap extra trouble upon him, because not only is he bearing the terrors from God, but he's also bearing the accusation of the friends. And this accusation, as we have seen already, builds up and up and up and up, to the point that Job becomes frustrated and angry with them in chapter 19. In verse 2 of chapter 19, after he's responding to Bildad's second speech, he says, how long will you torment me and crush me with words? 10 times now you have reproached me. Shamelessly you attack me. And I think it's partly because of the accusation of the friends and Job feeling that he needs to justify himself, that this leads him to demand that he calls God to account and answer, why? Why have you done this to me, God? And this reaches a pinnacle in something like Job 23. Job 23, verse 3, where he says, well, two for context, he says, my complaint is bitter, his hand is heavy in spite of my groaning. Verse 3, if only I knew where to find him, if only I could go to his dwelling, I would state my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would find out what he would answer me and consider what he would say. Look, if I knew where to find God, I would walk down to his office, I would burst into his office, I would put my case before him, and then I would listen to him. I would see what he has to say. I'm going to treat God fairly. I'm going to give him a chance to justify himself. And clearly Job has overstepped a line here. But nonetheless, let us not take away from the righteousness of this man. In chapter 31, he has a similar kind of sense. This is the last couple of words that he says. Chapter 31 and verse 35. Oh, that I had someone to hear me. I sign now my defense. Let the Almighty answer me. Let my accuser put his indictment in writing. Surely I would wear it on my shoulder. I'd put it on like a crown. I would give him an account of my every step. Like a prince I would approach him. God is accusing me, he's saying. And now I want to sign my defense against that accusation. I want to put my case to God. I want to let him realize what sort of man I am. And I would explain everything that I had done before him. Just as an aside, we sometimes have a little idea of the judgment almost like this. That we're going to be before the majesty on high and try to explain what we did. And I think that when we think such things, we're essentially falling into the same fallacy that Job is almost falling into. Job elsewhere makes it very clear that if he were called before the Almighty, there's nothing he could do but fall on the ground and plead for mercy. But the friends and the interaction with the friends have brought him to a point where he has been provoked to say, you know what, deep down, I feel I'm just. I feel I'm righteous. And God needs to take this into account. So here's Job saying, I want to understand what's going on. I want to understand why God is doing this. I want to state my case before him. Now there's a couple of interesting facts about the book of Job. Number one, we know exactly why these things have come on Job. And number two, Job never really understands that. He's never shown that. You see, we know, just by reading chapters 1 and 2, that these came on to Job not because of any sin that he had committed. We know that. We know exactly the circumstance of events that caused these things to come on him. And so we can look at it and say, we're with you, Job. You're not being condemned for unrighteousness. You didn't strip the poor and work the orphans into the ground and show injustice to your men servants and your maid servants. We know you didn't. And these things didn't come upon you because of any shortcoming in your life. They're not punishments. We know that, Job. So we know that because we have the advantage of chapters 1 and 2. But Job doesn't know that. He never receives a direct answer himself. And I'd like us to address both of these in today's and tomorrow's topics. They're kind of, today and tomorrow, run into a unity, because it's all about how God comes and answers Job, the questions that he's raising. So the first aspect about why it's happened fundamentally is because of Satan's jealousy, whoever Satan is, and because God permitted Job to be in Satan's power. That is the original cause of it all. It's because this man Satan says, I want these things to happen to Job, and calls down the powers of heaven to make them happen to Job. In other words, the things that happen to Job are an expression of the sinfulness of sinful man. They're not punishment of Job himself. They're an expression of the sinfulness of other people's sin. You see, God has this challenge, in a sense, that if he's going to give people on earth free will, freedom of action, then he also has to permit consequences to happen. There's a number of ways in which the Job and the Proverbs tie together. I've never given these two series of talks together, and it's actually interesting how interlocking they are. But what is freedom if whenever you do something, God immediately removes the consequences? I mean, it's like being, let's put it in political terms, it's like being in a state where you can go and you can vote for whoever you like, but if the wrong party got too many votes, then whoever's administering the election just changes the result. Where's the freedom? There's no freedom. There's no expression of will there. And it would be the same way. If we are free to sin, then that sin has to have consequences. It has to work itself out. Otherwise, we're not free to sin. We're not free to go against God. And so God has set the world up in such a way that we can either exercise goodness and righteousness, or we can exercise sinfulness and wickedness. But whatever we do will have a consequence. The drug dealer who is selling drugs, the selling of drugs has a consequence on those people who die. Or who take the drugs and use them. It has a consequence. It has an effect. And I think we sometimes say that the book of Job is about educating Satan, teaching Satan a lesson. I don't think it's about that at all. I don't think, actually, that Satan ever learns the lesson that the book of Job is about. We certainly have no record in the book of him learning that. Indeed, the first time Satan says that Job only serves you because you do things for him. God says, okay, well, let's take them all away. And Job is still serving God. Satan does not learn. Satan comes up with another reason for objecting and says, well, it's his flesh. Don't do something to his flesh and then he'll turn. And so perhaps if God had had another confrontation with Job, Satan would have found another reason to say, yeah, but the only reason Job is still following you is the following. So Satan, we have no indication that Satan is ever learning anything here. However, we learn, brothers and sisters. We learn by looking at the book. We learn what's going on. And so here, God is using the sinfulness of sinful man to teach lessons to the righteous who are willing to look into the book and are willing to learn the lessons from it. Those who crucified Jesus, did they ever get a sense of what they were doing? Did they learn a lesson? Did they realize that they were crucifying the Lord Most High? Whether they did or not is in some sense irrelevant. What is important is that we learn the lesson from it. That we see when people like us are confronted by righteousness, the loveliest man that ever lived, what do? We murder him. So Job was in Satan's power. He was bearing the brunt of the sinfulness of sinful man. But there are aspects in which God certainly wants to address the issues that Job has raised. And I think God does it in two phases. The first phase is that he sends Elihu to come along. And if we want analogy elsewhere in Scripture, I think we should think of an Elihu as a little bit like perhaps an Ananias who comes to educate Paul. The situation in Acts 9 is about Paul and Jesus. That's the major conflict, as it were, the major story. But there's somebody else who comes in to educate Paul a little so that he can progress in his relationship with Jesus. Or take David and God over the issue of Bathsheba. There's the situation. It's David versus God, or David with God. But he needs somebody else to come and direct him a little bit. So Nathan comes into the story. And it seems to me Elihu is this kind of character. Elihu claims to be a prophet of God, speaking inspired words. Look at a few things that he says in chapter 32 and verse 8. He first of all says, look, I stayed quiet just to hear your arguments. I was young, I thought the older people should speak. But he says, verse 8, it's the spirit in a man, the breath of the Almighty, that gives him understanding. It's not only the old who are wise, not only the aged who understand what is right. So God's breath, and maybe this is God's spirit rather than just the natural breath that we have. He seems to be saying it's God's Holy Spirit in a man that actually gives him understanding. And this is the perspective that he claims to be speaking from. He said it even more clearly in chapter 36 and verse 2. He says, bear with me a little longer and I will show you that there is more to be said on God's behalf. I'm speaking, he says, on God's behalf. I'm defending God before you. Verse 3, I get my knowledge from afar. I will ascribe justice to my maker. Be assured that my words are not false. One perfect in knowledge is with you. And so he's making a prima facie claim of inspiration and of perfection of knowledge. And traditionally, well, I think there have been two views in our community. One has been to accept that, and the other has been to say, no, he's just an upstart who has a false sense of who he is and is elevating himself. But I think when we look at how he fits in, there's a couple of aspects that are fundamental. First of all, after having claimed inspiration, and then we get the God discussing the outcome of the book, God doesn't mention Elihu at all. He does mention Eliphaz and his two friends and condemns them for speaking foolishly, for speaking wrong things. He condemns them and says, you need to go to Job and Job will lift you up. But he doesn't say that about Elihu. And indeed, if Elihu was a prophet of God who was sent just to add a little salt to that situation, then he was just a messenger of God anyway. And God wouldn't either say, oh yes, and Elihu spoke right. Of course Elihu spoke right, because God had sent him. I think there's another fascinating aspect, that Elihu is very much the one who introduces God. He recognizes that God is coming. We know in chapter 38 that the Lord answered Job out of the storm. So we've got this huge whirlwind that comes upon. I don't know if they were out in the desert. I often think of them on the edge of the city in a kind of desert plain, and they see this storm starting in the distance, coming closer and closer and closer. And perhaps at first they just think it's a storm. But Elihu, who's speaking at this moment, I don't think he thinks it's just a storm. I think he realizes that this is the presence of God, the literal presence of God coming upon them. And so I think back in chapter 36, towards the end of his speech, he starts talking about the storm that's coming. Verse 22, God is exalted in his power. And you can almost imagine him, and maybe I'm reading too much into this, but you can almost imagine him sitting there saying, you know, putting his arm out to the storm and saying, God is exalted in his power. Who is a teacher like him? And then verse 27, the theme is picking up. He draws up the drops of water which distill as rain to the streams, as the clouds pour down their moisture. Who can understand, verse 29, how he spreads out the clouds, how he thunders from his pavilion? Verse 30, see how he scatters his lightning about him. He's talking about this storm that's coming upon them. Bathing the depths of the sea, this is the way he governs the nation. Verse 33, his thunder announces the coming storm. Even the cattle make known its approach. And I imagine at that point there's a tremendous crack of thunder. And we get chapter 37, verse 1. At this my heart pounds and leaps from its place. Listen! Listen to the roar of his voice. And Elihu has no doubt that this is Yahweh in presence coming upon them. And so he's introducing God. Verse 14 of chapter 37. Listen to this, Job. Stop and consider God's wonders. Do you know how God controls the clouds and makes his lightning flash? Verse 22. Out of the north he comes in golden splendor. God comes in awesome majesty. The Almighty, beyond our reach and exalted in power, in his justice and great righteousness he does not oppress, therefore men revere him, for does he not have regard for all the wise in heart? And the storm is upon them, and the Lord answered Job out of the storm. And just the tremendous drama of the situation is almost overwhelming. So the very fact that Elihu knows exactly what this storm is and what it represents, and that it's not just a normal storm, but this is God coming, seems to me to indicate that he is particularly a messenger of God. Now it's interesting that Elihu does not try to attribute past sin to Job. In this he is completely different from the friends, 180 degrees removed. The friends have said, look Job, you're being punished, therefore you must have done something wrong. Elihu takes a completely different tack. Chapter 32 and verse 14. He makes it very clear here that he's not going to argue in the same way that the three friends. Job has not marshalled his words against me, and I will not answer him with your arguments. I will not come up with the same reasons for this that you've been coming up with, friends, he says. Verse 12, I gave you my full attention, you three friends, but not one of you has proved Job wrong. None of you has answered his arguments. And don't say, we found wisdom, let God refute him, not man. He says, look, I'm here to show him a better way, to show him the correct way. So he says explicitly there that he's going to have a different approach, a different set of reasons, a different group of arguments. Yet there are some points where some people suggest that he is actually attributing past sin to Job. Chapter 34 and verse 8 and 9, where he says, of Job. He keeps company with evildoers. He associates with wicked men, for he says it profits a man nothing when he tries to please God. But notice that what he's actually saying is, when Job says it profits a man nothing when he tries to please God, in that thing, he is keeping company with evildoers and associating with evil men. He's not saying that Job has a past association with evildoers and wicked men. What he's saying is that the conclusion that Job is coming to is one that puts him in association. And I think that God has a similar kind of sense in chapter 38 and verse 2, where God says, "Who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge?" Job, he's saying, in a sense, your speech is rebellious. There's no basis to it. It's words without knowledge. And so in that sense, he is joining with those that are wicked. And I think that that's the same sense when Elihu says in verse 34 of chapter 34, "Men of understanding declare, wise men who hear me say to me, Job speaks without knowledge, his words lack insight." Well, that's exactly what God said. So Elihu can't be wrong in saying this. Job is, to some extent, speaking without knowledge, has come to a point where he has gone beyond the things that he knows and is starting to challenge God. Verse 37, to his sin he adds rebellion. Scornfully he claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. And I think in chapter 36 there's another fascinating thing that he says. And again, we can misunderstand verse 20 of chapter 36 if we're not careful, where he says, "Do not long for the night to drag people away from their homes." You know, is he implying that this is what Job used to do? I don't think so. I think verse 21, if we carry on, he says, "Beware of turning to evil, which you seem to prefer to affliction." You've got a choice before you, Job. You've got this affliction upon you, and now, because of this affliction, you seem to be turning towards evil. And he's saying, watch out. Watch your step. Be careful where you're going with this. And he recognizes that Job has come to this point where he is confronting God directly. Chapter 33 and verse 8, he's about to quote Job. He says to Job, "But you have said in my hearing," I heard the very words, verse 9 of chapter 33, "I am pure and without sin, I am clean and free from guilt, yet God has found fault with me, he considers me his enemy." In other words, he's saying, look, Job, you're saying that you're pure, you're sinless, you're clean, and yet God is still punishing you. In other words, you're saying, hey, God, I don't deserve this. And that's what Elihu is saying that Job is objecting. And all of those are accurate. This is exactly where Job has got to. He has lived a righteous life, but he is railing against God, saying, why has this come upon me? I don't deserve this. Why are you hounding me, God? Why are you oppressing me so much? What is it you want from me, God? There's some other aspects of Elihu's message which I think show that it's completely different from the friends, and that's because a number of themes that he applies get picked up exactly in God's speech also. And if you look at chapter 32 and verse 2, this is the narrator describing the whole motivation behind Elihu and the thing that he said. We read, "Elihu the son of Barachel the Buzite of the family of Ram became very angry with Job." Why? "For justifying himself rather than God. God says in chapter 40, verse 8, would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself?" God picks up exactly the same thing that was motivating Elihu. And then, in fact, I think that is the key theme of the book of Job, and we'll spend all of the next session looking at exactly that theme. So the whole issue with Job was that he was coming to a point of discrediting God's justice, and this is what Elihu has to say in order to confront him. Now, I think that there's a fundamental thing that Elihu is involved in here that, if you think about the structure of the book in some sense, we have a situation where Job says, I want to call God before me. I want to have him here and give his case, and then I'll be able to listen to him and see what he has to say. So the very thing God cannot do is come to Job and say, here's the explanation. Because now he's at Job's beck and call. And the whole of the situation of the universe is turned on its head. And so instead, what God does is addresses the situation in two phases. He first of all sends Elihu as a human representative, as one that is Job's equal in some sense, who says, look, God's not going to come to your beck and call, but let me come and let me explain on God's behalf the situation that you should think about, that you should understand. And then that leaves God free to come, and not to try and answer Job's questions directly, but to make an independent declaration of who he is and how he runs the universe. I think the fundamental message that Elihu was to give here is that whereas the friends supposed that suffering implied the presence of sin, and it was punishment that was proportionate to the sin, Elihu argues that suffering is necessary for perfection. It's completely different. The friend said, if you're bad, you get punished. If you're very bad, you get very punished, if you can say that. Whereas Elihu says, suffering achieves a purpose in your life. But look at some of the phrases here. Chapter 33 and verse 14. God does speak, now one way, now another, though man may not perceive it, in a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls on men as they slumber in their beds. And so we know lots of examples of this. Nebuchadnezzar, Joseph, Pharaoh, lots of people. He speaks. And verse 16, that he may speak in their ears and terrify them with warnings to turn a man from wrongdoing, keep him from pride, preserve his soul from the pit, his life from perishing by the sword. God speaks in dreams, he says. He comes upon people in a vision in the night. Why? To punish them? No. To direct their life, to guide them from this way to that, to make sure that they don't fall down in the wrong way. As for me, my feet had almost slipped, said the psalmist. And Elihu is saying, and God takes action. He speaks to people in visions. Verse 19, or a man may be chastened on a bed of pain with constant distress in his bones, so that his very being finds food repulsive and his soul loathes the choicest meal. This is another way God works. It might not be with vision. It might be by bringing suffering upon someone, but it's for exactly the same purpose. It's to preserve his soul from the pit, his life from perishing by the sword. It's to help turn them away from evil. They might not have got into evil. God doesn't want to. God isn't a God who's interested in punishment fundamentally. God is interested in prevention. He wants to turn us away from evil before that evil has happened. And Elihu says sometimes he uses pain. Verse 21, his flesh wastes away to nothing, and his bones once hidden now stick out. His soul draws near to the pit, and his life to the angels or the messengers of death. Yet he says, verse 23, if there is an angel or messenger on his side as a mediator, one out of 1,000, to tell a man what is right for him, to be gracious to him and say, spare him from going down to the pit, I've found a ransom for him, then his flesh is renewed like a child's. It is restored as in the days of his youth. And so God sees something where an individual needs to be guided, and so may bring pain and suffering upon that individual, and may even supply a messenger, an angel, to come and discuss with that individual and guide that individual, so that a point will come where they can come out of the other side of the pain. And this theme is picked up in the New Testament. Look at Peter's letter. Peter's letter is written at the time of the persecutions in Rome. And indeed, it's almost certainly written from Rome when Nero and his people are literally burning Christians up by wrapping them in tar and setting fire to it, or sending them out into the circus to be torn apart by wild beasts. And so Peter says in 4:12 of his first letter, "Dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering as though something strange is happening to you." It's not strange, it's not unexpected. Rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. Chapter 5 and verse 8. "Be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. Resist him." And I'm sure he's talking about the Roman power at this point. And in particular, has the sense of being thrown into the circus. "Resist him, standing firm in the faith, because you know that your brothers throughout the world are undergoing the same kinds of sufferings." Why did God let our brothers and sisters perish in that way in the circus in Rome? Because he was punishing them? Because they'd done something wrong? Of course not. But the punishment, the suffering, the discipline that was coming upon them was so that they might participate in the sufferings of Christ. So this whole discipline theme, of course, is one that is thoroughly developed elsewhere in Scripture. The one that we looked at before when we were thinking about Proverbs were the ones expanded in Hebrews 12. Let me just read a couple of verses here. Verse 4, "In your struggle against sin, you've not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood, and you've forgotten the word of encouragement that addresses you as sons. My son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you. Because the Lord disciplines those he loves and punishes everyone he accepts as a son." The discipline of the Lord may be through insights and visions and dreams and things like that, or things that we read in the Scriptures. Or it may be by laying us down on a bed of suffering, or putting us in the power of one who is opposed to the things of God. This whole aspect of being in the power of sin, where we suffer the consequences perhaps of other people's sin, I think is a fundamental message of not only the book of Job, but of all of Scripture. Come to Romans 8, and you'll see Paul expanding exactly the same theme. We've talked about it very briefly, but we'll mention it again. "I consider," verse 18, "that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us." Job, "I consider that your present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in you." Verse 19, "The creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to," and the NIV has the word frustration, which is pretty good. The King James has the word vanity, which is pretty good. But I think the best word here is futility. "The creation was subjected to futility, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it." You don't want the things of your life to essentially be futile, to have no direction, to have, in a sense, let me be careful here, but in a sense, to have no meaning. And why do I say no meaning? Well, the NIV word in Ecclesiastes is meaningless, meaningless. It's meaningless. God has set this world over to this notion of being in some sense meaningless, that we're under the power and the ability of those who have no care of God at all, for a very good reason. "For the creation was subjected," verse 20 again, "to futility, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God." Why is it
that this world is subject to futility, to vanity, to meaninglessness. It's because otherwise you would think that there was some great value and some intrinsic benefit in this life. But God has bound this world over to futility so that you realize this cannot be it. And you lift up your eyes and you look to eternity. And you realize that there has to be something more. That this life cannot provide the answers, cannot provide the value, cannot provide any purpose. And God did that deliberately. He deliberately robbed this world of any intrinsic meaning so that we, in itself, I mean, apart from our relationship to God, in the world itself, so that we would turn to God, so that we would reach further, so that we would long for eternity. So we get to a situation with Elihu, I think, where it's perhaps not too much to say that if discipline is designed to improve and perfect us, then perhaps it's most likely to overtake the relatively most perfect. The more perfect you are, the more God may want to just hone you that little bit more, so that you achieve that little bit more. Unless you say, well, then I better hold back because I don't want that. Remember, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. So it's a case of taking a deep breath and saying, okay, God, I'm ready. Bring it on. Because I know that I need to change. I know that I need to grow. In my flesh there dwells no good thing. It needs to be eradicated. I need to be a different person. And I can't do it myself. So I think Elihu brings a completely different perspective to Job, one that he's not considered before, and certainly one that is entirely different from the way the other friends are addressing him. But now the situation comes where Job has to now face God. The sort of logical and rational side of it is given. The explanation is given as to how Job should think about things. But nonetheless, he now needs to be there with God. And let's just remind ourselves of the attitude that he starts with as he's coming up to God. In chapter 13 and verse 19, he says, verse 18 for, or 17 for context, "Listen carefully to my words, let your ears take in what I say. Now that I have prepared my case, I know I will be vindicated. Can anyone bring charges against me? If so, I'll be silent and die." I've prepared my case. I've logically written down everything that I know about, and now I'm ready to argue it. And nobody can bring charges against me. Chapter 19 and verse 5. "If indeed you would exalt yourselves above me and use my humiliation against me," NIV says, "then know that God has wronged me and drawn his net around me." Verse 7, "though I cry, I've been wronged, I get no response. Though I call for help, there is no justice," says Job. And then those verses that we read in 23, remember, he says, "if only I knew where to find him." This is verse 3 of 23. "If only I could go to his dwelling, I would state my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would find out what he would answer me and consider what he would say. I'm calling God to account. And I'm willing to listen to him." And instead, of course, as we know, by the end of the book, Job is a very different man. In chapter 42, he says, verse 5, "my ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." He finds an honest appreciation of himself. And I think in verse 5 there's that lovely distinction between knowing about and knowing. And we talked about it at the weekend. Do we know about Jesus or do we know Jesus? And in verse 5 he says, "my ears had heard of you." I had heard about you, but now my eyes have seen you. It's not seen things about you. I've actually seen you. I've come, as it were, face to face with you. And so now I'm a very different kind of person from who I am. What was it that God said to bring this transformation around? And I don't think it was just God. It's the whole passage starts with Elihu laying the foundation, and then God has two tremendous speeches. And the first thing, of course, is that God turns Job upside down. It's not, okay, Job, I'm ready to answer you. Not at all. It's exactly the opposite. Verse 2 of chapter 38, who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. It's completely the other way around. We don't have time to look into it in any detail, but go back to Acts chapter 7 at some time. The speech of Stephen, the whole of that time before the Sanhedrin. Who is on trial there? Just ask yourself, who is on trial? Stephen's speech does not make sense as a defense speech. It simply doesn't. Stephen's speech is the case for the prosecution. And the trial there is that you have the Sanhedrin and you have God and Jesus sitting as judge. And Stephen is giving the case for the prosecution, saying, almost ignoring the things that they happen to say to him, standing up and saying, let me tell you the way it is. Up to the point where he says, look, you've always resisted the Holy Spirit, and now you continue to resist him. And it's the words culminating in the case against the Jewish people. It turns it completely around the other way. And so it is here. Job had wanted to confront God, but what he discovers is that God confronts him. And this first speech, we're not going to cover it in any detail, but I'm sure you know the sweep of it. Chapter 38 in the first few verses talks about the earth and the structure of the earth. Where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand, and so on. From verse... then there's another section there. Seasons and so on. Chapter 39 is all about animals. For example, verse 1, do you know when the mountain goats give birth? Do you watch when the doe bears her fawn? And the whole speech is about, do you realize, Job, the power that is needed to sustain creation? Whether it's on the structure of the earth, whether it's on what's going on in the heavens, right to the farthest stars that maybe you can't even see. And the animals, do you think the animals just carry on by themselves? Or do you think that I actually have to be involved, continually helping to sustain life? It's not just an automatic process, Job. I'm there. I'm participating in it. And so we get to a situation where God is confronting Job with this. Now, interestingly, Job already knew about lots of this. Look back in chapter 9 and verse 8. It's not that this is a revelation to Job. Let's go in at verse 5 for context. Job 9 and verse 5, talking about God. He moves mountains without their knowing it and overturns them in his anger. He shakes the earth from its place and makes the pillars tremble. He speaks to the sun and it does not shine. He seals off the light from the stars. He alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. He is the maker of the Bear and Orion, the Pleiades and the constellations of the south, and so on and so on. I know about that, says Job. But I think what God is saying, yeah, you know about it, but do you know it? Look, realize the power that is behind it. It's not just some facts in a textbook that you should say, well, with the intellectual part of my mind, that yes, I accept that. Do you really feel that, yes, God is in control and he's guiding every aspect of creation? And so Job already knew about this, but now he really knows it and he recognizes his insignificance when confronted by God. And so because of this awesome power that the Lord presents to him, we get the response in chapter 40, where he says, verse 4, I am unworthy. How can I reply to you? I put my hand over my mouth. And what's that mean? I put my hand over my mouth. it says, I shut up. I stop speaking. And indeed, Job had already used this as a sign of respect, or talked about it as a sign of respect that others used to show to him. Let me just read 29 verse 7. When I went to the gate of the city and took my seat in the public square, the young men saw me and stepped aside. The old men rose to their feet. The chief men refrained from speaking and covered their mouths with their hands. And now Job is saying, I get it, Lord. And he covers his mouth with his hand. Now, if the book of Job finished here, I think a lot of commentators would be quite happy. Because a lot of commentators simply don't understand the next speech of God. But I'm going to argue something else. If the book of Job finished here, we would be devastated. Look at what Job says in chapter 9 and verse 14. This is just after talking about the destruction of Egypt in the Red Sea, if you recall, in verse 13. Job says, verse 14, how then can I dispute with him? How can I find words to argue with him? Though I were innocent, I could not answer him. I could only plead with my judge for mercy. And that was the verse that I didn't find earlier, that when I was meaning that we sometimes think at the judgment seat that we're going to stand up and give an explanation of what we did on July the 13th, 1985. Though I were innocent, I could not answer him. I could only plead with a judge for mercy. We're not going to be arguing back to the judge. And Job recognizes this in himself. And he says, look, God is so awesome, I actually know that if I was before God, then even if I was innocent, he would just overwhelm me with his power and his authority. And so indeed, that's what we see in the first speech, where God displays his power to Job, and Job says, I'm overwhelmed. And so if this is all we had, then we would only see the terrible almightiness of God. We would have a sense of saying almost, well, there's no justice here. Because even if Job is innocent, yet just when confronted with that awesome power, he just cowers as we would all. And so I think we have to have the second speech for us to see more in our God than just the mightiness that controls the universe. But we'll have to leave that for tomorrow.